a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Call a meeting to order, and I'd like to have an opening prayer. Marianne is going to send it.
Grandfather Tugashira Ujimaka, today we are here in the state capital and with a blessing today for that health and that help and our children's future, Grandfather Tugashira. As we look upon the things that we do here and all of us involved with the representatives, I want to say thank you to each and every one of them and the senators and to the governor and to everyone and all our tribal chairmen and all our tribal representatives and all of us that we work together in doing and enduring the things that we have coming towards us at this time.
Thank you. I just have a couple of things I want to say, but of course I'll say them at the close. But I really, as chairman, I'd like to thank everybody that served on the committee, and I want to thank all the people who come and testified in our previous meetings, and everybody that's hosted us, and all those people out there on the internet, if you're listening, I want to thank you for listening in. And if you have any comments or anything, don't be afraid to contact us here at the LRC in the capital. And with that, I will introduce at this time Jay Bolt, who has a presentation from the Historical Society. Mine's making that noise.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am J.D. Vogt. I'm director of the South Dakota State Historical Society and also the State Historic Preservation Officer, which is oftentimes referred to as the SHPO or the SHPO. We are currently a division in the Department of Tourism and State Development and not aware of where Governor-elect Dugard's plans are for the society at this time. We are meeting with the transition team on Thursday, and hopefully some discussion will take place about that. The state legislature created the State Historical Society in 1901, and today we implement six chapters of state law, the National Historic Preservation Act, and elements of other federal legislation. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be with you today and talk about the society's interaction with tribal governments. The Sioux Horse effigy, which is part of our logo, is one of our famed museum artifacts. It is believed that this dance stick was carved by an unknown Sioux artist or a Sioux warrior in the 1870s in honor of his war horse who was making his last leap of life. An interesting story that goes with this particular artifact in our collection is that in 1976, in honor of the nation's bicentennial anniversary, the Kansas City Art Museum put together an exhibit called The Sacred Circle. They brought together the best American Indian art in the United States together, and this was the centerpiece of that particular exhibit. Then as part of the bicentennial, I find it interesting, it went to London to go on display also. And while in London, the European art critics declared this the finest horse sculpture in the world. And if you open almost any American Indian art book, there will be a photo of this particular piece in that book. The State Historical Society actually operates in five program areas: archaeology, archives, historic preservation, museum and research and publishing, as well as we have a very small development and administrative unit. I believe most of what you're interested in hearing from me about today is archaeology and historic preservation. However, I first want to quickly go over some of the other activities our other programs do in working with individuals and tribal governments. And feel free to interrupt me if you have any questions as we proceed. The most important project that we do in our archives area that directly relates to tribal governments is our American Indian Archives Project. The project involves locating and copying, usually by microfilm, records from the Bureau of Indian Affairs and other federal agencies related to South Dakota tribes and reservations. The records held by the National Archives are voluminous, difficult to use, and largely inaccessible to people who cannot travel to Washington, D.C. or other repositories. Among the records we now hold are census rolls, letters received, general correspondence, allotment records, reports, publications, and special case files. And we've just hit the tip of the iceberg on what's out there. We would like to create the most comprehensive collection of archival material on American Indians in South Dakota. However, this program will end or will be severely cut back if the governor's recommended cuts are put forth as we expect. A good example of how these records have benefited South Dakotans is in the case of Wolfchild versus the United States. Now, Wolfchild dealt with Sioux lands in Minnesota that were confiscated by the United States government. The descendants of that land whose land was taken were eligible for reimbursement for those lands that were confiscated, but those people had to prove their lineage to the people who owned the land originally that was confiscated. And we assisted many individuals in their research. When requested, we also put on seminars and workshops on genealogy and how to do it for American Indian people, which is different than doing it for non-Indian people. And we explained what resources we had available. However, without the Indian Archives Project, these individuals would have had a far more difficult time, if not impossible, in improving their lineage. Our award-winning exhibition, The South Dakota Experience, was put together with the assistance of American Indian advisors throughout its three phases. Oyate Tawi Chohan focuses on American Indian culture and history prior to the contact with non-Indians, but with an unusual twist for a history museum. The advisors told us very strongly that they were not particularly enamored with museums. They saw museums as representing things that were dead and gone. And they were very clear that as American Indians, they were not dead and gone, nor was their culture. So in dealing with those particular issues, we sought their advice and suggestions, and as a result, we use a lot more native language in this particular exhibition. And in addition, to show that the culture is still very much alive, we display next to historic pieces contemporary pieces that are representative of the same type of object. So it's really a nice way of blending those two areas. In Proving Up, we discussed the movement of American Indians to the reservations, the rise of the ghost dance religion, and the massacre at Wounded Knee. In that exhibition, we have a ghost dance shirt that was repatriated from the Wounded Knee Survivors Association from the Glasgow Museum in Scotland. The association asked us, the State Historical Society, to take care of that object for them until they had a facility suitable to hold it themselves. And further, on the 10th anniversary of its return to the tribes, we took the shirt to a special ceremony in Eagle Butte. We offer several education kits to schools, local groups, and other interested organizations on various topics. Two kits cover American Indian culture and heritage and history, Buffalo and Plains Indians, and Dakota, Nakota, Lakota life. Traveling exhibits we offer, and one spotlights American Indian art, Living Traditions, Nakota Lakota Art. Because of the fine scholarship and their unique design, our traveling exhibits received an award of merit from the American Association for State and Local History. The South Dakota State Historical Society Press is an academic-style publishing house for state and local history. In the 41 books we have published, 5 adult titles are on American Indian topics, and they're listed there on the slide. Another 4 have been children's books: American Indian artists Don Montalo, S. D. Nelson, and Marty Tubol Sr. have provided illustrations for us also. We have scheduled 3 future biographies on American Indian leaders, a book on winter counts, and another children's book written and illustrated by S. D. Nelson. For the past 40 years, we have been publishing South Dakota History, the quarterly journal of the South Dakota State Historical Society, and it's a benefit of membership. As a member, you'd receive the quarterly journal. It just so happens that the last 2 editions, one was a special issue on Sitting Bull, and another had an article on Charles Eastman. If I had to venture a guess, approximately 100 articles in the 40-year history of this journal featured American Indian topics. And one of the elements of this is in the back of the journal, we have what we call Dakota Profile, which profiles deceased South Dakotan of worth, and 28 of them have been American Indians. However, I think what's really important in our discussion today is the interaction between the state archaeologist, the state historic preservation officer, and the tribal historic preservation officers. They kind of form a triangle of activity involved in what we do. Now, in South Dakota, we currently have 6 tribal historic preservation officers, or TIPOs, THIPOs, or THPOs, all known by any one of those things. One application is currently pending, and that's the Crow Creek Reservation. And 2 tribal governments are without a tribal historic preservation officer, and I think that will continue in that way. THPOs apply to and are approved by the National Park Service. And under the National Historic Preservation Act, the State Historic Preservation Officer has 10 major responsibilities under the Act that we're required to do throughout the state of South Dakota. Now, THPOs, or Tribal Historic Preservation Officers, can assume those responsibilities of the State Historic Preservation Officer, those responsibilities they wish to assume within their exterior boundaries of their reservation. So THPO operates like the State Historic Preservation Officer within the exterior boundaries of their reservation. The archaeology program is located in Rapid City, and this is our archaeological research center situated in 2 connecting pole buildings at 2425 East St. Charles Street in Rapid City. You may recall 2 legislative sessions ago, the governor recommended eliminating this operation, and Jim Hague is the current state archaeologist and director of the program. This program implements one chapter of South Dakota law, Chapter 120, dealing with archaeological exploration in the state. And they work very closely and through the Archaeological Resources Protection Act, or ARPA, and spend a lot of time working with NAGPRA, the Native American Grave Protection and Repatriation Act. One of our major tasks as the state archaeologist is to conduct a statewide archaeological survey, basically identifying the location of archaeological sites throughout the state. However, almost all our survey work is driven by federal and state projects because they pay for the work. We do not have a separate budget available to just go out and do archaeological survey work where we think it's important that it be done. So we rely very heavily on project-driven work. Since the formation of the program in the mid-1970s, we've conducted approximately 2,200 surveys and excavations and or excavations in the state. We have done some cooperative survey projects with the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe and the Sistan Wahpeton Oyate. And together with the Oglala Sioux Tribe and their THPO, we monitored a water line installation near Wounded Knee. How we approach archaeology today is far different than it was just even 10 years ago. Archaeology all used to be about digging. Today it's more about preserving and protecting sites. A few years ago, the state legislature passed confidentiality legislation for archaeological sites. We hold all the archaeological records, survey material, gray literature, and library on archaeology in South Dakota, as well as we serve as the official repository for federal and state materials that are archaeological in nature. When human remains are discovered, and after local law enforcement has cleared the burial from being a crime scene, the state archaeologist takes over. And there's this one little caveat there. If it's within a cemetery, an unmarked grave is found. It's the health department issue. If it's outside a cemetery, it's the state archaeologist situation. If the burial consists of American Indian remains, NAGPRA, the Native American Graves Protection Repatriation Act, applies. Since the late 1980s, we have been involved in 3,100 cases of human remains and associated grave goods and 140 unintentional discovery of human remains. I would guess any year between 10 and 15 unintentional discovery of human remains are located in South Dakota and we deal with. In addition, NAGPRA involves the return of any currently held human remains or grave goods to appropriate tribes. Working with NAGPRA requires consultation sessions with interested tribes as part of the process of determining who should receive the repatriated remains. Our database shows 95 pages of consultation dates and attendees regarding NAGPRA issues. We have met with representatives of every tribe in South Dakota, the three affiliated tribes, and at least eight other tribes that have South Dakota considered as ancestral lands. Yes, Senator. Generally speaking, the items that may be buried with the person, fragments of clothing, how it was buried, there's a number of different clues to indicate that. Within the last year and a half, there was a burial discovered in Deadwood that they couldn't determine whether it was a Chinese burial or an American Indian burial. So they worked together with the Chinese consulate, American Indian tribes, and actually the Catholic Church, because it was outside a Catholic Church cemetery, and all three groups dealt with the reburial of that individual. In 2008, for Archaeology and Historic Preservation Month, which is held annually in May, we featured a bank stabilization project of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe. The Historic Preservation Program, sometimes just simply referred to as SHPO, is located in the Cultural Heritage Center. I serve as the State Historic Preservation Officer, and Jason Haug is the director and manages the program. Historic preservation is about preserving, protecting, restoring, and rehabilitating cultural and historic resources, such as archaeological sites, buildings, sacred places, and structures. The work of the Historic Preservation Program is governed largely by the National Historic Preservation Act. This is federalism at its absolute best. The federal government sets the policy, provides most of the funding, and lets the states implement the policy as they see fit. In addition, the program also works with state statutes and local governments. want to highlight one level of recognition from the federal level. South Dakota has 15 National Historic Landmarks. A National Historic Landmark is the highest level of historic designation that exists in the United States. And we're quite proud of our 15. There's a 16th one pending currently. I try not to brag too much because if you go to Philadelphia, there might be 15 on one block. So we have to be very careful about our pride. However, in South Dakota, most of our National Historic Landmarks are archaeological sites associated with former American Indian community areas. We work, in addition to National Historic Landmarks, there's the National Register of Historic Places, and we have approximately 1,300 properties listed in the National Register. And by properties, I mean it could be individually listed, it could be a district, or it could be a multiple property listing. A district is, you know, best understood as being like a main street area, business area. A multiple property listing is a little more complicated. It may be the same type of property scattered all over the place. And a good example of that in South Dakota is our rock art multiple property listing. There's rock art listed all over the Black Hills, but it's individually listed in this one particular massive nomination. The National Register of Historic Properties, or their eligibility to meet the National Register criteria, is the basis for all historic preservation decisions. It is the bedrock of what everything is based upon. The area where most of us intersect with tribal governments and how it connects with archaeology in South Dakota is Section 106. Now, Section 106 is a short paragraph in the National Historic Preservation Act. It's literally two sentences long, that requires federal agencies to take into account cultural and historic resources in any undertaking or project in which the federal government is involved. Federal government involvement could be their land, their money, grant. It could be issuing a permit, giving permission to do something. That would make it a federal undertaking. And if it were potentially to impact cultural historic resources, they need to follow the Section 106 process. And basically, all it really means is that the federal agency needs to identify if any cultural or historic resources or properties exist in the project area, determine if they will be affected negatively, and if so, how will this adverse effect be mitigated or minimized. When the project involves ground-disturbing activities, usually an archaeological survey is needed. And so that's why we get archaeology, historic preservation, and tribes, because most archaeological sites in South Dakota deal with American Indian issues. In this process, the federal agency, and I emphasize again, the federal agency is supposed to consult with either my office as a State Historic Preservation Officer, or if it's a reservation that has a THPO that's taking place on those areas, they have to consult with either myself or the appropriate THPO, and we have 30 days in which to respond, period. If the information is not sufficient to make a decision, our decisions either we concur or we don't concur with what the federal government has determined. And if there's not enough information to make an intelligent decision, we might ask for additional information, and we've got another 30 days until they give us that, and when they give us that additional information. But basically, the state and the tribes have 30 days in which to respond to those. We have worked with THPOs concerning Section 106 process, providing requested guidance when needed, participating in public meetings, and developing memorandums of agreement. Now, there's another issue in Section 106 that's a little more complicated, which is very confusing. Again, under Section 106, the federal agency must either consult with the State Historic Preservation Officer or the appropriate Tribal Historic Preservation Officer. However, tribal governments that have an interest in former ancestral lands or traditional lands can ask to be consulted also at any time. Their authority is far different than serving as the State Historic Preservation Officer or the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, but they have the opportunity to comment to the federal agency with their wishes regarding that particular project. We work with South Dakota tribes and those in surrounding... Excuse me. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Do all the tribes have a preservation officer?
No, they do not. Three currently do not. One is pending, Lower Brule and the Flandreau Sioux Tribe do not have tribal historic preservation officers. They interact with us more in seeking cooperation with our office. I would say that they're the same level. I mean, my jurisdiction is throughout South Dakota, except on those reservations where the tribes have taken over that responsibility. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Good question. We work with South Dakota tribes and those in surrounding states to ensure federal agencies are taking into consideration historic properties, specifically those identifying identification of places that are of our religious or cultural significance. There is actually quite a bit of conversation between my staff and tribal historic preservation officers, keeping abreast of what's going on. Sometimes they want us to participate, and sometimes we say, you know, this is a project I think you may want to participate, but they would not have been notified otherwise. And so there's a lot of good communication going on there. We participate in meetings to develop legally binding programmatic agreements, or what we call PAs, or memorandums of agreement. Currently, the most significant one we have we're operating under is a programmatic agreement with the Army Corps of Engineers. It's very clear that the lowering and raising of the water level on the Missouri River is a undertaking that has the impact of harming cultural or historic resources. Lowering and raising of the river has for years disturbed graves along the Missouri River. And so through this programmatic agreement with the Corps of Engineers, which took at least 2 years to negotiate, the tribes that signed on and our office recognize that that's an undertaking, and the Corps of Engineers is doing other things to mitigate it. So we don't ever have to see a project anytime they want to raise or lower the Missouri River. We've got an agreement in place where they're taking care of that on an ongoing basis. We also have an agreement with the Custer National Forest for the treatment of historic properties affected by oil and gas leasing and development, so that we all are we know where everybody's going and what's going on, and it's not a big issue. About a month ago, my staff and I met with THPOs and cultural officers from 11 different tribes to discuss preservation issues in South Dakota. And during that meeting, we were asked, or my office was asked, to obtain information to clarify for some projects. We had a nice discussion about the potential of the Game Fish and Parks purchasing Blood Red National Historic Landmark site or portion of that land, and how that might potentially impact tribal interests at that particular site. The South Dakota State Historical Society participated in Governor Rounds' Year of Unity. We provided a reading program to libraries on American Indians and other ethnic groups in the state. In addition, Francis Whitebird has served a term as an elected member of our Board of Trustees, and Governor Rounds has appointed Lower Brule Chairman Mike Janru to our Board of Trustees currently. Overall, I believe we have good communication and working relationship with tribal governments, and particularly tribal historic preservation officers. And if there's any specific material you'd like me to present, you know, provide you after this presentation, I'd be glad to do so. And if you have any questions at this time, I'd be glad to answer them for you. Thank you very much.
One, in your workings, down there, they're redoing Highway 18 between Pine Ridge and Ogallala, and somewhere I heard they were checking out, supposedly, if there was any, they were going to be disturbing any sites. Do you pretty much leave that up to their historical people, or do you get involved in that?
Well, in that case, because that those reservations areas have tribal historic preservation officers, we would not be involved unless they asked us to. The irony of what that is that recently on the Oglala area, they were putting in a water line, and they asked my archaeological office to come out and help them monitor the work that was going on just in case some archaeological materials came up in the process of working on it. So there's all kinds of levels of cooperation that are going on.
Well, that's good to hear. Any other questions? Representative Pitt?
We've got great response to the education kits. Pretty much throughout most of the school year, they're booked up all year long. The traveling exhibits, that's a little different because they need venues that people can show them. Sometimes schools use them in conjunction with an education kit. Sometimes a local museum will use it for one of their purposes. Or sometimes banks will put them in their lobby just to have something to draw people in.
Well, I want to thank you a lot, Jay, for your presentation. And if there's no more questions.
Thank you.
Yeah, we insisted they talked about that, remember? Yeah. That was really very interesting. And
I want to make sure I answered whatever questions came up so that if you've had anything that specifically you needed, you just went in the closet.
I think Tom had something from. Tom, did you have anything?
Yeah.
I just wanted to make sure that I covered what the issues were that
puppet system.
They had talked some about consulting with maybe some other state agencies as well, like DOT that has a lot of highway projects and that kind of thing. The person who brought it up there talked about more consultation.
Okay.
More structured ways of making sure that consultation happens.
Yes, he did mention that up there. You're right.
I'm familiar with that situation.
Well, fortunately, he wasn't my employee. If he was, he'd been a former employee.
Along that line, I remember as a small boy out at Upper Cut Meet, we were riding horseback. Some of Clarence Swan's boys and myself, and we discovered just going over a hill there through his pasture, and all of a sudden we looked down, and one of them said, "There's some bones," you know. So anyway, we went home and told Clarence. Of course, when I was a boy, that's a long time ago, but come to find out that they did come out from Rosebud and checked it out, and here it was a small trunk and a wagon box, and they were not native people. They were people going through in an early day, and they never did nothing with it. I mean, it just was non-Indian people who had died in the transportation through the area. So like you say, I mean, the determination, as you said, is how they know if they're native or not was pretty much by what they were buried with. Yeah. You know, it was a small child and a
and they said it was a female woman that were buried there. So nothing was ever done because there was no marker, no nothing, and it wasn't any of the native people there. But I would assume now they would do a real thorough investigation if they found those in this day.
Typically, if that'd be the case and was reported to law authorities, they would then contact the state archaeologists, and we would come and remove the body and take it back to Rapid City, and then later and reinter it.
Jeff, so
thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm trying to go back to the meeting in Sisseton when we got on this tangent, but and that was something, because historically, prior to the white man, the burial they didn't bury. So it's really in the advent, you know, they were the other type of ceremonies that the natives used to dispose of the bodies after that. And I was that was very informative for me to be made aware of that. So where I'm going is, Jay, is so what you're dealing with is after settlers started coming through and
changed. Actually, you know, in terms of burials, if body or bones were found on the surface, that would still be considered a burial, and we would come and deal with it if there was anything left that hadn't been disintegrated over time. But yeah.
Well, once again, I want to thank you, Lodge, for coming.
Thank you.
I'm sure it enlightened some of us about something I didn't even realize myself. You got a pretty important job, really, too. So thanks again.
Thank you.
I want to go back, you guys, because lucky you, I forgot to take roll, so now that you're here, Senator Maher.
His absence will never be noted.
You want to take roll?
Representative Ironclad. Representative Killer. Representative Pitts. Representative Wink. Senator Allers. Senator Maher.
Here.
Senator Russell Olson. Senator Teason.
Here.
Representative Junkie.
Here.
Senator Bradford.
Here.
Well, we still don't quite have a quorum, but we're not going to do any big business right away anyway. I think we're a little ahead of schedule.
We're a little ahead. I've got a couple of things.
Okay.
Things that came up from Sisseton when I called some agents.
Yeah. This time I'm going to turn over to Tom.
Mr. Chairman, at the Sisseton meeting, there were some questions that came up, and I, rather than have additional speakers come, I just made a couple of calls and tried to answer some of those. And I'll go over those briefly. One was, there was a question on veterans benefits for National Guard members. A member there was not able to use state benefits at a tribal college. And in checking into that, I think the most likely benefit that they're talking about is the half tuition that National Guard members get. And that's by statute, and that's for any member of a South Dakota National Guard unit. The catch is you need to go to a school under the jurisdiction of the Board of Regents or else a state vocational technical institute. And if you do and you're a member of a guard unit, you get half credit, but it's not available at a tribal college. One other interesting thing about that program is the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs pays the tuition money to the Board of Regents and to the state for the vocational schools so that the Regents' budget is not affected. But I'm pretty sure that that's the program that he would have been talking about, and the reason that it didn't work is because it was not a state school. Another question that came up
at the Sisseton meeting in September had to do with a concentrated animal feeding operation near Veblen, a large dairy, and possible contamination of streams and surface waters from that facility. I called DENR about that. They said it's actually two dairies under the same ownership. And in 2009 and 2010, which were very wet years, the level of wastewater in their holding ponds got higher than it should have been. There was one small or minor discharge near the pond, which was pumped back in. There was also a minor discharge from a land application. The department said that they had done a number of inspections and also took enforcement actions, which included penalties and compliance scheduling. They said that both dairies are in bankruptcy and they're in the hands of trustees. Both are currently in compliance, but the situation is a little volatile, and they're continuing to inspect it. I think one thing that causes confusion there in that area is the checkerboard nature of the land. It's not a contiguous reservation area. There will be tribal land interspersed with private land, and it's hard to tell, you know, what's being impacted at any particular time. The department has dealt with the tribe, but I don't know that they have a specific mechanism for dealing on a regular basis, and they say that things are in compliance, but that's as much as I can find about that particular situation. The last one, or one other one that I wanted to comment on, or that I made a couple of calls about, there was testimony there about a questionnaire used by the department or the Division of Motor Vehicles for people who want to qualify for a 3% motor vehicle excise tax exemption if you reside on tribal land, is the way that it was described. In order to implement that, the Division of Motor Vehicles had a form in order to try and identify who the person was and where they lived. There was some controversy about that form. Actually, this has gone on for a while. There were about 10 years. 10 years ago, there were a couple of court cases involving the Cheyenne River Sioux tribe, and later the Sisseton Wahpeton tribe was involved. Basically, the court said that a person could be exempt from that excise tax on a motor vehicle if number one, they're an enrolled tribal member, number two, they reside on tribal land of the same tribe. So there's a fair amount of information that they need to determine in order to determine whether the person qualifies. What I passed out is a new form that they did in 2009 in response to criticism on the old form. The last three pages are the old form. They felt that there was too much personal information being requested there and so on. So the form was cut down, and the first two pages are what they use now. In 2010, the Sisseton, Wahpeton, Oyate contacted the Civil Rights Commission or the U.S. Civil Rights Commission about this, and I'm not sure of the results of that. But as it stands right now, the shorter form is what's being used in order to identify if someone qualifies for the exemption. And I can check into that more if you want.
On this very thing, Treasury, offspring, for Shannon County, was, if you look at the old questionnaire, it says supplemental questionnaire, to be completed by the county treasurer. Well, not to be completed by the county treasurer, it has to be completed asking for the exemption, and Shannon County's not very hard, it's real easy. The problem with these is the ones that are like Kennett County, Collette County, Rick County, talking about counties that are not totally reservation land, but there is a predominant prorated, and that's where the real sticker, some of the county treasurers are upset, and of course, people are, not any different anywhere. He's living in Bennett County, he's an old member, and he's living on his inherited tribal land, but he's only got 5 acres, 10 acres, the motor vehicle exemption is for driving that vehicle on the reservation. How much time are you actually on the environment? Not on it very much, but he still wants the full exemption, and that's where they run into all the problems. I can see where, like, Sisseton is really tough because, you know, they have reduced that so small that the treasurers have put it. Thank you, Tom, for doing that, checking on that, because those were some of the things that were mentioned in Sisseton, that some of the problems they'd had. I want everybody to know that we took them seriously, and he did a good job of checking on that.
Yeah. Just so I've got this clear, do we understand then that the complaint or comments that we heard then in Sisseton were most likely related to the old form?
Yes.
Because it appears that those issues have been reasonably addressed, at least in the new form. I mean,
And I'm not sure if this is satisfactory to them, but that's what they were trying to do, was address the problems that came up in the old form.
Okay,
Mr. Chairman, down here. Now, will somebody from this committee follow up with the tribe and relay this information back to them? That we, you know, what we found out in our findings or anything in a, like a letter form or anything? To Sisseton?
Well, I'd leave that up to Tom here. Do you have some?
The only reason I say is because sometimes we go out to these tribes and we show up and we listen, but then they never hear back from us.
Yeah.
And it's just like, well, our comments fell on deaf ears, and it'd be nice to have a little follow-up conversation. Hey, we did look into these. This is what we found out.
Well, I think maybe on all of those issues, maybe Tom should respond with what he found out, the veterans issue and all of it.
Or maybe just take a copy of these minutes and just forward them a copy of the minutes on of this meeting.
Could do that, too.
We can put together a letter.
Yeah. At least to let them know that we appreciate it when they bring those things to us. You can at least check and do something if it's brought to you, but if it isn't, you don't. So that was it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe I'm not getting the whole, but this is a 2009 form, and we were just up there, you know, two months ago. Is the treasurer, I mean, is this not getting to the treasurer of, I believe it's Roberts County? Because we had that complaint just came up when we were there this fall, and it sounded like it was a recent concern that was raised when the committee was there. I wonder if maybe the new form hasn't been utilized by their county treasurer. You think I'm off base on that, Mr. Chairman?
I
I don't know, because see, a lot of this comes at different times. In other words, 2000, you know, and I know that licenses are staggered now. So it kind of depends on whether the form was there in time for when our meeting was or not. I doubt it, but we could still tell them that that we investigated and checked into it.
Well, not to belabor the point, but I guess I suspected that this may have been an old complaint, because my recollection was that during the discussion there were members, other members in the room that acknowledged that the form had changed in recent times. I think I heard someone acknowledge that a new system had been put in place. So I'm hopeful that this is that form. And looking over this form, I mean, it takes the requirement of the treasurer signing off on it out of it. That was part of the problem. And secondly, the requirement for, you know, proving up residency is not unlike other proof of residencies that I've seen for driver's licenses or other sorts of exemptions that anyone may have to apply for. So,
well, I think too that even with the new form, I know some of our people complain because it gets into their personal life. You know, they even want to know where you go to, kids go to school, and they want to know who you're working for. And of course, all my kids said nobody. But I wanted to say though, one thing is that once you make it out, once it's done, they don't make you do it again. So it's a thing that, as long as you're licensed in the same reservation and don't move, that's over. You just go back and renew your plate, and your exemption's given to you. So. Did you have something else? Okay, Representative.
Talked to them, it was before they sent the form to me. They sent the form to me after as a result of the conversation. But, yeah.
I was just wondering how that
I might enlighten you a little bit, because here's the situation, and I didn't really want to get into it, but let's say that the person's, the actual child is living in Rapid City, but he licensed his vehicle at the folks' in Pine Ridge. Well, with that Pine Ridge license, he would then be exempt, and he wouldn't have to. And it's not a refund. There's no refund in this. It's just they don't pay it into the county. You understand? Technically, here's the thing. It's the one tax that the tribe does not want to make a duplicate ordinance for. In other words, if the tribe would make a duplicate ordinance from each of these reservations, then the tax would be collected no matter who you were, and it would be given back to the tribe. But what happens, it's the people themselves have said they don't want the tribe to get this money. They want it to go to the actual member. And that's what it does. It's not a refund. It's just an actual member exemption tax for every single tribal member who lives on the reservation. And in these cases here, they live on the reservation where it's checkerboarded. They have it's kind of like the way the gas tax is collected is it's on a percentage basis. For instance, Rosebud doesn't get as much gas tax back as Pine Ridge does on a percentage basis. Same way with this. So that's part of it. And so if your kids are in school in Rapid City, and you're that's part of what it's, you know, they designed it to try to catch a few cheaters. So with that, I think we pretty much go on to is Mike here?
Sure.
Mike, maybe we could turn this over to you and several other people. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mike Lighthold. I'm the sheriff of Hughes County in my full-time job. I'm also on the Council of Juvenile Services, where I have the pleasure of serving as the vice chair. I'm here today because our chair, Carol Tweet, who is a Minnehaha County Commissioner, was unable to be here today. So we're here today with others from the council to talk to you about the Council of Juvenile Services, and in particular about the Tribal Justice, Juvenile Justice Advisory Group, the Tribal Advisory Group. To give you a little background, the Council of Juvenile Services was created by statute in 2003 when the legislature changed the state law so we would comply with the core protections of the juveniles under the provisions of the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act. And I'll refer to that in the rest of my remarks as JJDP Act, so to kind of shorten that a little bit. The change in the law meant that juveniles held in a jail or a secure lockup facility had to be sight and sound separated from adult prisoners. It further required that a child with a CHINS offense, which is a child in need of supervision, could not be held in a secure lockup facility. We've brought with us today copies of the council's annual report, the 2009 annual report, which I believe you have. And most of the information I have is in that report today. The council is appointed by the governor, and the members serve three-year terms. There are several areas of expertise and experience required in the composition of the council. A complete listing of that is on page 2 of that annual report. The responsibilities of the council are several, and they include establishing policy for the administration of the formula grants program, which South Dakota is eligible to receive under the JJDP Act, approve the state plan, and award and monitor the grant fund. That's roughly in the $660,000 a year range for the grant fund. Assist the Department of Corrections in monitoring state compliance with the Act. Study the coordination of the various juvenile intervention, prevention, treatment, and rehabilitation programs and effective juvenile sentencing, adjudication, and diversion policies and provisions. Contact and seek regular input from juveniles currently under the jurisdiction of the juvenile justice system. Submit annual recommendations to the governor and the legislature concerning functions of the council and the status of our state's compliance with the JJDP Act. Study the appropriate administration of and provision for children in need of supervision in South Dakota and make an annual report to the governor, the UJS, and the legislature. Perform other activities that are determined by the governor, the secretary of the Department of Corrections, or the Council of Juvenile Services. In fulfilling our mandate, the council has identified the following problems to be addressed through formula grants, funds, and activities. Our number one priority is monitoring and maintaining compliance with deinstitutionalization of status offenders, jail removal, sight and sound separation requirements of the Act, as the Act was amended, being critical for continued juvenile justice system improvement. And then disproportionate minority contact. Minority youth, primarily Native American youth, are overrepresented at most stages of South Dakota's juvenile justice system. The Native American tribal juvenile justice systems have a critical lack of basic resources to address the needs of youth coming before their tribal courts, thus compromising their due process and outcomes. Because South Dakota has one of the highest incarceration rates of detention per capita, there's a need to develop alternatives to detention, commitment to the Department of Corrections or out-of-home placement for young offenders, children in need of supervision, special needs offenders, and low-risk delinquent offenders. There's a need for significant expansion of community-based prevention and early intervention programs and services to include prevention, effective early intervention, children and family services, such as child abuse and neglect, mental health services, developmental disability services, services for children in need of supervision, prevalence of substance abuse among youth in the juvenile justice system, education, and fetal alcohol syndrome disorder. To further expand on some of these problem areas today, I'm joined by two other members of the council, Ellery Stone, who is chair of the Tribal Juvenile Justice Advisory Group, and Susan Randall, who's chair of the DMC Committee. Following Susan's remarks, you'll have the opportunity to meet Chad Nielsen, and he's Native American Outreach Coordinator at Lutheran Social Services in Minnehaha County, who will tell you about the Hochoka Diversion Program he has launched under the DMC initiative. And, of course, we'll stand by for comments and questions at the conclusions of Chad's remarks. Ellery.
Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Ellery Stone, and I'm a member of the Yankton Sioux Tribe, and I'm a project manager for a correctional facility that's under construction. I'm also the chairperson of the Tribal Advisory Group, and I serve on the Council of Juvenile Services. The Tribal Advisory Group, also known as TAG, was established in 2004, and it's comprised of members of each of the nine tribes. In the it's also referred to as TAG, and it provides a Native American perspective and expertise to assist the Council of Juvenile Services in meeting the requirements of the JJDP Act, and provides communication between the tribes and the council to assist tribes in their juvenile justice initiatives. As I said before, the TAG is an assembly of individual tribal members who run a gamut from judges to probation, treatment providers. Most of the people that are on the TAG coming from the tribes are working directly as service providers to juveniles. As I said before, we first met in 2004 in Crow Creek, South Dakota. We come together quarterly to share resources and information, to learn from each other and our invited guests. We try to have a guest at each of our meetings that's going to provide information on what types of programs and services that might be out there that'll assist in the area of juvenile justice. We provide education and advocacy to stakeholders in the juvenile justice system. And South Dakota Voices for Children provides the Tribal Advisory Group with staff support, and the Council of Juvenile Services provides the funding for the Tribal Advisory Group. When we first met in 2004, we didn't know who did work in the juvenile justice with the other tribes. The Tribal Advisory Group has enabled probation officers, tribal prosecutors, tribal judges, CD counselors, court administrators, and others working with youth to get acquainted, share our problems, and learn of resources available and discover new ways to address some of our challenges. To expedite our connections, we created a Tribal Juvenile Justice Directory that's updated annually. It has two sections in it, listing the individuals who worked in the tribe's juvenile courts and related services by tribe and then by position. I brought a copy for you, Chairman Bradford, and for the Legislative Research Council staff. If other members of the committee want a copy, we can make them available. In the planning process completed in 2008, the Tribal Advisory Group members identified six goals to address. Increase understanding the institutional barriers that tribal youth face in education, identify and address policy barriers that limit state tribal service referrals and placements, promote cultural competency training for all public employees that deal with tribes, access current funding streams that are known for juvenile justice system needs and prevention services, pursue stable funding for juvenile probation officers for all nine tribes, identify and obtain tribal-specific prevention programs for youth. A major gap for tribes is the lack of stable, sustainable funding for probation officers. Excuse me. The Council of Juvenile Services has allocated $138,363 for tribal juvenile justice needs, and all of the six tribes in 2009 that applied for this funding used it for the purpose of juvenile probation. There were five supplemental awards to five tribes in the amount of $123,000. So the Council of Juvenile Services passed through $261,394 to the nine tribes. All of this funding went to provide probation officers. There are very few of the courts in the nine tribes that are able to fund a probation position with the money that's received through the Bureau of Indian Affairs 638 contracts. So the Council of Juvenile Services funding that does provide for these positions is basically the only funding or one of the only sources of funding for juvenile probation in the tribal court system. As Sheriff Leinholt noted when he reviewed the council's problem statements, the critical lack of basic resources to address the needs of youth coming before the tribal courts compromises due process and outcomes. There are members of the tribal advisory group that are here today, and I would like them to stand to be recognized. TAG members. Thank you. And these are members, like I said before, these are members from the nine tribes, and there are judges, probation officers. And what TAG does is come together on a quarterly basis to discuss needs of Native youth in the juvenile justice system. And at this time, I will turn it over to Dr. Randall. Okay.
And as Sheriff Leinholt said, we'll all be around, so that I suspect you may have questions, and we look forward to that opportunity for dialogue. I'm Susan Randall. I'm the director at South Dakota Voices for Children. I'm a member of the Council of Juvenile Services, and I was appointed by Commissioner Carol Tweed, who's the chair of the council, and Mike Leinholt is the vice chair, to chair of the Disproportionate Minority Contact Committee. So I'd like to share with you a little bit about that work as overseen by the Council of Juvenile Services. First of all, back to the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act. This federal act first passed in the 1970s and reauthorized since then. It requires states to study the prevalence of disproportionate representation of minority youth in the juvenile justice system. South Dakota did complete this assessment and examined the six decision points in the juvenile justice process. It examined arrest, placement in detention, whether a formal petition was filed, as alleging a chin or delinquency. Another decision point is whether the court adjudicates the child as a delinquent or a chin. Another decision point is whether the child's placed on probation, or finally, the decision to place the child in the Department of Corrections. So those are the six decision points. All minorities in your state that constitute 1% or more of the youth population are to be examined, looking at these decision points to see if there's disproportionate representation of that minority in your juvenile justice system. The most recent data that we have is for 2007, and I will just digress to say it's frustrating that there is always this lag in having the actual data to look at, but that's just the reality of collecting this data and reporting it. The most recent data that we have from 2007 reports on these decision points and reports on the largest disparities, and they are for Native American youth and for black youth. You will find the statewide data appears in this annual report in the tables on pages 15 and 16, and I might suggest you take a look at that. And I'm sorry that not everyone in the audience was able to get a copy. We had a finite number of copies available. But if you have one and you're in the audience, you might share these. Okay. First of all, let me just say a little bit about how this gets measured. The statistics that is used to look at disproportionate representation of minority youth is what's called the Relative Rate Index, and sometimes called the RRI, and you can see that it's reported there. If the rate is a 1, it means that there is no disproportionate representation, meaning that Caucasian youth and minority youth receive essentially the same likelihood of that dispositional choice or of that decision point, being arrested, being placed in secure detention, placed in Department of Corrections. So a 1 means no disproportionality. If it's higher than 1, it means there is a greater representation of the minority than of Caucasians. And if it's below 1, it means that there is not disproportionality functioning. The greatest disproportionality in the research that's been done occurs for Native American youth at the stages of arrest, where statewide we have 4 times greater likelihood that a Native American youth would be arrested than a white youth, and then at the stage of detention, where it is twice as likely that a Native American youth might be placed in detention than a Caucasian youth. And as I said, 2000, or the table on page 15, the last year for which we have data is 2007. We're awaiting the 2008 data, but it does go all the way back to 2002. And you'll note that, in fact, the data shows that the arrest disproportionality, for example, for Native American youth in 2002 was 2.23, meaning twice as likely that a Native American kid would be arrested. It looks like it's gotten way worse by 2007. It looks like there are 4 times more. But I'd like to explain something that's actually improved about our data. When the baseline was done in 2002, that caused, of course, all of the systems to take a careful look at their reporting, and there was a lot of non-data about race in the tort records and other records. So all of the people in the juvenile justice system, from law enforcement through the courts, have begun to be much more conscious about making sure that racial data is reported. And as a result, you know, that's one of the explanations, I believe, for why the numbers appear to be worse. It's actually that we're probably more accurately reflecting what's going on by 2007 than we were in 2002, because we just didn't have as systematic data. And I think that's, you know, that's a benefit. But for policymakers, we certainly want you to be aware that the 2002 data doesn't show how many non-filled-in blanks there were about racial data. Is that, do you understand that?
I have a question. Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I have a question. Is this statewide or is this reservation?
This is statewide
this
data.
Is statewide.
And this is the state court system and the state juvenile justice system. It is not tribal system.
It does not include
they're not
tribal
included.
Courts.
Correct. Okay. Because of tribal sovereignty, their data would be collected separately. So, to respond to this, several measures are currently underway under the guidance and oversight of the Council of Juvenile Services to try to address the disproportionate representation. To tackle this, pilot projects were funded and started by the Council of Juvenile Services in Pennington County, in Minnehaha County, and in Roberts County. And they were have been in place over 3 years. Each county has formed a DMC work group that meets at the county level. It's composed of key stakeholders within the system, and interventions are underway that seek to address the disproportionality. A summary of these interventions does appear in your annual report, in our annual report on page 13, and I'm not going to read through those, but I'll just reference that. One of the promising interventions is the HOCHOCA program, which Chad Nielsen from LSS, Native American Outreach Program, has researched, adapted, and implemented in Minnehaha County as a component of the DMC pilot there. And I'm glad that Chad was able to be here today to tell you about the HOCHOCA diversion program. I think that maybe we'll segue to that, and then, of course, we'll all stand by for questions as they might arise. Okay?
I've got...
Yep. Yes,
one
Senator
question.
Mm-hmm.
I see that the total breakdown, but would there be any way to access, and I don't want to be facetious, but Pennington County?
Yes, I can. In fact, I have some of the data for each of the counties. I work closely with a DMC project in Minnehaha County. I'll just tell you briefly, I have the breakout for, it wasn't put in the annual report, but I have the data as it was provided to the Council of Juvenile Services for the DMC trends in Minnehaha, Pennington, and Roberts County.
Okay, that's all.
Okay.
I'd like to look at that.
Sure.
I want to thank you, Chairman, and the committee for having me here. And I want to thank Susan for inviting me or setting this up or arranging it, and the Tribal Advisory Group for the work that we've been able to do over the past few years. I'm just here to tell you about the program that I've started. I'm actually working through the disproportionate minority grant. They're the ones that allow me to do the work that I do. And it goes back a couple of years. I visited with Judge Kearns out in Rapid City, and she and I were having a conversation about restorative justice, because really restorative justice is an interesting way of looking at working with youth in particular, because it's developed on principles and values. Mostly, if you've created some harm, you have an obligation. What's the obligation is to take care of right what's wrong, basically, and trying to seek a different way of working with youth, and trying to seek a way that's really a little bit more culturally appropriate for Native youth, perhaps, because the system doesn't seem to be working real well sometimes with Native youth. So I went to Minnesota, and you'll have to excuse me, I kind of got a cold. I apologize for my voice, but I went to Minnesota, and I did a week-long training with Kay Prentice. She's works with the state of Minnesota with their restorative justice model. And then I did some more training with a man named Howard Zier, who's written several books about restorative justice. Came back to Sioux Falls and developed a program identifying stakeholders in the community. For example, who are the stakeholders with juvenile justice? We've got several different ways of looking at it. Some of it's just about truancy. We know that the systems interlap. So schools interlap with the juvenile justice, which interlap with the social services department. But we looked at four areas of behavior. One was antisocial behavior. One was truancy. One was relationship problems at home. And one was drug and alcohol issues. And I tried to develop this purely as a prevention program. We've got, we're really tasked by the state with, by the committee, really, with two different issues. One is really prevention, and one is supporting the success of those youth who are already in the program or already involved with the juvenile justice system in one way or another. So perhaps it might be looking at a way to reduce recidivism. So we look at who the stakeholders are. It would be the school, the parents, the youth. If they're stealing, it would be the stores or the community, the businesses involved, for example. There may be mental health issues, so it might be a counselor would be involved. It might be a probation officer, because they might be in another program. And I went to the state's attorney's office, and I asked her if she would use this model as a diversion program. She allowed me to present it to the judge. Excuse me, I'm sorry. To the presiding judge, Judge Severson and Judge Lieberman, and they approved the program. We started working about, we started collecting data just about 16 months ago. So our initial data is just very short-term data, and it's a small model because I'm the only one using it. The other thing is that the program itself is really designed in two different areas. One is outreach and one is, so I have direct service in outreach and direct service in the diversion program. So if the youth are, if the state's attorney refers a youth to me, I meet with the parents. We do an application packet. Once the, it's completely voluntary, they can certainly go to court rather than do the diversion. Once they agree to work with our program, they're there for 6 months. And we expect the parents to support as much. If the parents aren't available, then grandparents are fine. If grandparents aren't there, then aunts or uncles. We just want some adult with this youth. And even asking the youth to identify a couple of friends that they have that will be willing to come with them, positive peer. We separate them out, boys and girls. We meet boys twice a month and girls twice a month in group session. And then on the weeks when I'm meeting with the boys, I'll be seeing the girls individually at school. So we keep in touch with their parents, the school resource officers, the school attendance clerks, anyone else involved in this child's family. And then we invite community members to be volunteers in the support group. So we're trying to help these youth see positive, productive, successful tribal people in the community that they can lean on, that they can use as support and encouragement. We also have, like now, because we've been going for a while, we actually have a couple of youth volunteer, youth that have gone through the program but want to come back and volunteer as a peer support group. So we're seeing some change. The initial data that we see is really, really strong in terms of grades and attendance at school. Those have been the thing. We haven't had enough time to really do like a year-long recidivism yet. This was the first quarter that we actually had for six youth that were had been out for a year. That all looks good, but we don't have any. It's just a very small amount. So that's basically the other part of the program is the outreach. So we do community groups. We've got a group on Thursday nights that meet, that's open to the community to do cultural activities like beadwork, Dakota language, different things like that. And then there's a working with some of the grassroots agencies. Then we do indirect services in terms of training. So working with other agencies like American Indian Services, LSS has been able to pull in people, train on a professional level. We trained over 60 counselors and social workers and LPCs, mental health workers, and CD counselors to help improve cultural competency. So that's kind of what the program is. It tries to address it on a multi-dimensional, multi-level. So I want to thank you for your time. And this is, Dr. Randall said, we're certainly welcome. Yes, sir.
Did you say you are you in, where are you located, in Sioux Falls?
Sioux Falls, yes, sir.
So is this an operation if is the same thing going on in Rapid City that's going on in Sioux Falls or no?
The DMC regional work group committees don't get to work together a lot. I had a call from them last year, and they were trying to get something similar to this started, and we haven't met on a state level for a while, so I don't know if they got that off the ground or not. I can't give you that answer.
Sir. One other question I wanted to ask you was, now in your outreach or your diversion, if you go to the judge, then is the child, when he goes into your program, is he go back to the home?
Yes, sir.
That's where he comes into your...
Yeah, the diversion is really for first-time nonviolent offenders. So they're not eligible for the program anyway if they're already in the system. I do outreach, like, for example, I'll do a group out at West Farm, or I'll bring people from West Farm to our community group. But if they're in the system, they're not eligible for the diversion. Oh, yeah. The offenses are like truancy issues, like if the school's going to file a truancy, shoplifting. There was one youth that came to school drunk, one youth that was fighting a lot at school, but nobody was really hurt. It was just argumentative with teachers. One youth got kicked out of school for kind of aggressive antisocial behavior type, but not where there was any real physical harm. Thank you, sir.
I was just going to say that in 2005, Mountain Plains Research did, at the time that they worked to establish the baseline 2002 data about the relative rate index for overrepresentation, they also worked to conduct focus groups all across the state with youth in the juvenile justice system, with parents who had kids in the system, and with stakeholders in the system. And they went to various areas around the state, reservation communities, and some of the major, larger-sized communities, Sioux Falls and Rapid City. And as one might understand, there is no one silver bullet that explains disproportionate representation. There are many things. Among them are, yes, there may be bias operating in the system. Sure, that's one thing operating. Another issue is the challenges for minority populations who live in poverty circumstances and struggle with inadequate resources, and that leads to sometimes to children not having the foundation of support and services around them, and so they act out and end up coming to the attention of the juvenile justice system, of law enforcement. So there are a whole complex array of things, and it was that whole complex array of things that led to the identification of the three pilot sites and also of the various interventions that are underway. In Minnehaha County, for example, the Hochoka Diversion Program and the Native American Outreach, which Chad leads, is one of the things underway in Minnehaha County. Another aspect aspect being funded in that pilot is positive Indian parenting, which is a parenting protocol or program, I should say, conducted by Kim Kenoria from Great Plains Psychological Services, and she offers the Indian parenting classes. And then there's a work group that meets every couple of with monthly or every 2 months, and the purpose of that is to try to be sure that we are talking to each other, stakeholders across the system, about the challenges Native kids are facing in the system, and that we identify problem areas and that we try to find solutions and address it. Chad, am I missing those three things? Seems like there's a fourth element to it. I guess those are the major interventions underway. Pennington County has unfolded differently. So each pilot had a local work group and is engaged in its own convening of the stakeholders and attempt to address it. There's a new initiative underway that the Council on Juvenile Services has launched in collaboration with the court system that I had hoped we might have had the representative here to talk about, and it might be something you'd be interested in a future meeting, and that is the Juvenile Detention, JDAI, Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative, which is very data-driven and is underway in both Pennington and Minnehaha counties. It's just launching with collaboration from the presiding judges in both of those circuits, as well as law enforcement, detention center staff, state's attorneys, public defenders, treatment providers. It's all of those partners are at the table. And the goal is to both, first of all, really understand what does the data tell us about why are kids being placed in detention, which, by the way, in Minnehaha and Pennington County is one of the areas of overrepresentation. There are three decision points. I checked the data, Senator Bradford. In Minnehaha and Pennington County, those two counties, they have disproportionate representation at the stage of arrest, and it's very high. It's like 8 times the rate for white kids in those two counties. A overrepresentation at the stage of detention. And then the third area is at the stage of placement into DOC. Diversion, not overrepresented. So, you know, their kids are getting into diversion programs. Kids are not necessarily being adjudicated more widely Native American versus white. So they're just certain decision points. We need to study those decision points further and understand what's going on. And the JDAI initiative will be able to use a nationally developed model to really study that data and not have data that's 2 or 3 years old, but data that's looked at based on, you know, a set of cases within the last 12 months and find out what were the reasons these kids were placed in detention. Were they appropriate? Were they really high risk? Did they need to be in detention? Or were they placed in detention because they couldn't find a parent or they couldn't find an appropriate place to place the child, but they really aren't a danger to themselves or the society? Those are the kind of questions that will be asked of the data. And then at the same time, a group will work on identifying a risk assessment that all the stakeholders will say, yep, these are the right reasons why we should place a kid in detention. So they have to agree to those risks. And then they'll start to use that risk assessment to make decisions about whether kids get placed in secure detention or not. And then another group will be working on a full continuum of alternatives for how a kid that comes to the attention of the juvenile justice system might be have his needs addressed or her needs addressed. So I see the JDAI initiative as having a lot of potential for showcasing, if you will, a different way of doing things. And it's just in its very beginning steps right now with this being underway. The work, however, of the Annie Casey Foundation with JDAI initiatives in other states has found that when they focus on detention, they also often begin to address disproportionate representation, and that starts to that isn't the major focus of this. It's about kids being placed in detention. But since we have disproportionate representation at that decision point, it also often helps to address the issues of overplacing Native kids in detention. It was a long answer, but
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I don't think it takes a genius or anybody else to know that the arrest rate from the juvenile clear to the adult is over proportionate Native American. I don't think it takes anybody those of us at least who have been involved in this. And my thoughts is anything being done to try to help on the beginning so that the person isn't just arrested just because of color or because of who he is. So that's my in this I see from even from our own perspective, the juvenile judge at Pine Ridge, of course, is my former sister-in-law, and I have a lot of visits with her, Sonny Kay, and she really does an excellent job. But she is heavily overworked, and a lot of times the handling of juveniles isn't always being done by expertise. I mean, in other words, an officer who has a fifth grade kid tell him to F off and all these things that are, he's automatically going to get upset, you know, and some of that's some of that's being done without knowledge that it's really, really not, he's not upset, he's just, there's somebody else he's upset with, not really the police officer. So I guess what I'm really interested in, and really very, very interested in, and that's for all kids, is what we're doing to more or less prevention, as the gentleman said, small things lead to big things, and if the prevention's there, somebody caring about you and caring for you, you know. And so I guess that program was very, very interesting to me, because from the beginning, in all sorts of law enforcement, you know, the beginning is where it's important, not after. And so many times we here in the legislature, we pass laws for after. We don't do things over in the prevention side. So it's, and especially with our children, you know, they're really, really very, very precious commodity, and they're going to be running things down the road. So we need to look out for them. So
anyway. In your studying, do you notice that in your youth, I'm going to use Pennington County, for example, are these youth coming off the reservation, or are they growing up in Rapid City?
I think I can't speak for Pennington County.
Okay.
Maybe someone here?
I don't know, maybe some other. The reason I bring it up is because, you know, out on the reservations, we have such a lack of law enforcement. And then all of a sudden, whether these youth are relocated to Rapid City or to whatever other metropolitan area off reservation, you have a lot more police enforcement. And then all of a sudden, oh my gosh, we've been doing this all our life growing up on the reservation. All of a sudden, we're following a whole different set of rules. And then all of a sudden, we're into the youth system or into the court system. I was just curious if there's any correlation with that.
Well, what I understand you're talking about is just the differences in how communities maybe respond to behavior on the part of young people. And I know that there are differences. But the other thing that Ella Ray spoke to, and that the Council of Juvenile Services has tried to register with senators at the congressional level and representatives, the tribal juvenile justice system, which I understand is now what this is about. This is reporting data on the state, tribal, court, and juvenile justice system. But the tribal juvenile justice systems are very under-resourced. I mean, they struggle with law enforcement. And there's been this big initiative to have more law enforcement, which is a good thing. But if you get these kids in the juvenile court and you don't have any probation officers, all you have then is a law enforcement so you can lock, you know, bring them in. And then maybe you have a detention center so you can lock them up for a while. And then you maybe have a prosecutor who can prosecute it and a judge who can make the decision. But then no probation. I mean, that's an essential function to any good juvenile justice system. So, I mean, it's just incredible to me that that is a missing link in stable funding for the tribes, which, you know, you've already heard how all of the funds that the Council of Juvenile Services has made available to tribes, and it's modest when you divide it up among the tribes. It's not enough for even one full-time person. It's maybe $25,000.
Right, and you see that full well in hand on Standing Rock right now. You have this insurgents, what they call the insurgent, coming on to Standing Rock, and they're rounding up these people, and they're incarcerating them for 24 hours, and then the court system's overwhelmed, and so what do we do? Let them go because there's nothing they can't handle it all. So it's back. They haven't fully followed through with whatever they're trying to accomplish or prove up there.
With all due respect, I'd like to note that Jeannie Hovland is here. Do you want to raise her? She's from Senator John Thune's office, and she just met with the tribal advisor group a few minutes ago. And we also heard about some court assessment initiatives. I don't know, Ella Ray, do you want to speak a little bit about what's underway? Well, there's the assessment of the tribal court systems and both where the strengths are, and we just heard about that in our tribal advisor group meeting, and apparently it's an assessment underway among many of the tribes, and then the goal is that out of that assessment and findings of where there are deficiencies, that there'll be an opportunity for some solid recommendations and then hopefully funding that will follow the federal level. Yeah. And Judge Marshall, you spoke a bit about that from Rosebud. Did you want to say anything further about that? If you do, you should come up here so it gets recorded for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Sherman Marshall. I'm Chief Judge at Rosebud and also at Flandreau. Now, there are several initiatives underway. Some as part of the Tribal Law and Order Act, I think. And there's also a study sponsored in part by Senator Thune to study what's available on the reservations and to see what's being tried at the national level and how those are meshing. So we had a meeting with some people from the Government Accounting Office, and they spent 2 days at Rosebud to look at our resources, look at what processes are in place to see if they can address that, to see if they're finding better ways to at the federal level, at the tribal level, to mesh what's going on at the tribal level and what's being tried at the federal level, so that those federal initiatives are being accomplished. So hopefully that's something that they're going to come out with a study in January here sometime. I think that'll give us as tribes a better handle on and the federal legislators a better handle on how to address things on a reservation. So.
I'll give you. I realize that Sherman, in the standpoint of addressing it on a reservation, but. We need to somehow be involved so that that child, when he gets to Rapid City and when he's, as the saying goes, he's maybe with grandparents there and stuff, and these kinds of things, I understand, you know, it, as a tribal judge, probably you know the circumstances behind the child and everything, but when he reaches that a juvenile judge in Rapid City, they have no idea. They just look at him and say, "You're a bad kid, and you're going to go to Plankington," or as they used to tell me, "Go to Plankington." but but. Otherwise, I just wondered if there's any correlation between you as a tribal judge, juvenile judge, with a juvenile judge in Rapid City or Pierre or Sioux Falls. Do they have any of that correlation? I know you said you're correlating with the government. I mean, I understand that too, but. But the big problem is our children. There's many, many more off of the reservation than there is on.
Well, I think part of it is probably maybe a little bit more collaboration between probation officers who serve tribal kids and probation officers from the state level, if they can get together and talk about these things and have, you know, a line of communication. So if a child from Rosebud, let's say, goes to Rapid City or Sioux Falls and gets in trouble, you know, if they have somebody that knows that kid from home, you know, and what resources are available, and see what the best way for helping this kid. Same thing at the judge's level. I know the Supreme Court Judge Gilbertson has invited tribal judges to come to their annual judicial conferences, and I think they've provided training, and we've come at times, and I think it'd behoove us to invite some of the judges to our tribal setting so that we can talk about things like this, and not only for juveniles, but for things like the Indian Child Welfare Act, that we could pick up a phone and talk to the other judge about, maybe we have a juvenile that's problematic for them and problematic for us, or that we can help on either side of the fence, so to speak. So I think those kinds of efforts will go a long way in addressing this kind of thing. So.
You had a question, Senator Tien?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that was kind of the gist of the question that I was waiting to ask, is that I was wondering what the council has done or is doing in regards to cooperation between state juvenile courts and authorities and tribal. I retired from law enforcement in Rapid City in 2007 because I'm so much older than Sheriff Leithold. But when I left law enforcement in Rapid City, the level of cooperation between tribal juvenile authorities and state juvenile authorities in Pennington County was nil or very, very close to nil. I'm not aware of any level of cooperation that existed between those two. And to make reference to Senator Maher's question about the number of children that move back and forth between reservation and big city living in Rapid City is significant, very significant. And the difficulties that arise from trying to deal with a child that spends half his year in Kyle and half his year in Pine Ridge and is perhaps running into difficulties in life and with the law in both places is significant. And when there's a lack of cooperation in communication, I'm not saying it's really lack of cooperation, it's a lack of simple communication. I always found it very interesting that it was very difficult to accomplish anything meaningful with that child, and was living basically two different lives in under two different jurisdictions. So I'm wondering if that issue is being addressed and maybe is way better than it was 3 years ago when I retired.
Part of the problem, Senator Teason, is you're dealing with nine sovereign nations and then. State. I mean, obviously, we can't force them to do anything. I think the tribal advisor group was a good first step because, as LRA said, when they first got together, a lot of them had never even talked. And that would be our goal, is to further those cooperative issues. But it's going to take cooperation on everybody's part. And it's really almost above our pay grade. I mean, it's really almost. It's because each of those are sovereign nations. It's something we can certainly strive for, but it's nothing we don't have any leverage to make anybody do anything. We can just encourage them.
And if I might, I guess I understand that. I mean, I've dealt with that issue throughout my career as well, but it is fundamentally true that if we wish to positively impact those children's lives, we must figure out a way to cooperate and communicate in order to make that happen, above and beyond our separate nations and our separate governance and so on. And we must be able to communicate if we're dealing with a significant number of children that are in that situation. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And along that same line, as Senator Teason has said, The problem is you say that they are a sovereign nation, and they are. But when that child reaches
Rapid City, he's no longer in the confines of his own security in what may be a small issue at home. Can be a big issue. I know for a fact that in my son and daughter's case, they live in Rapid City, and there's quite a few Indian families there. But what some kids would walk into school the same way, my grandson too. And they cut through the back of this one yard. It was closer than to go clear around. You know what? They came down to school. A policeman come down to the school and pulled those kids out of class and told them that you're going to be going to court if you go through that yard. Well, yeah, they were. They probably were. But at home, you know, we'd have just said, "Just be sure you don't go where the grass is growing or something." I mean, I'm just relating to a small incident, but those kind of things happen. You know, it's and so I think that what we need is a little more communication. As the old saying goes, no communication. You don't know. And so I just think that communication between you, Sherman, if you're a juvenile judge on two reservations, your communications with a judge, a juvenile judge in Rapid City or Pier, especially probably as you work closer to Pier, but with our judge in Pine Ridge would be really good. That juvenile judge could be correspond. As you said, even if it's pick up a phone and say, you know, I have Kobe Bradford here in court, and he's enrolled member down at the tribe. And is there, what do you think? You know, is this a simple kid that just made one mistake or whatnot, and it would help, and it would, might, this one time might have this kid go the right way rather than get resentful and go the wrong way. So that's, but communication's a big story.
Representative Pitt. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Somewhat of just a comment, and I don't know if it was Mr. Nielsen or Dr. Randall, but you just very briefly mentioned the term positive parenting program. And I have to say, after my years of school board, county commission, legislature, and a parent of four, that I think we're missing the boat if we don't work on those programs with parents. I think that's just a huge part of this issue. And sometimes we let it go to the side. I know in the school board, I always felt that we needed to get those parents in the schools in whatever way it took to get them there. And I would just encourage us to continue working on that, because if we have kids growing up without that positive parenting, then they don't know how to positive parent. So I would encourage us to continue to do that and to work with the law enforcement. I probably wasn't in the same situation as Senator Bradford, but I remember being sent home a couple times by law enforcement. And that was probably the best thing that happened to me, rather than to be arrested and taken somewhere else. That would be very traumatic to a young person. So whether you have comments on that or not, I would encourage us to continue very strongly working with parenting programs. I just think that they have a far wider reach than continuing trying to fund and support, which is important for law enforcement, but those parents are huge. Thank you.
Well, Sherman, I already want to thank you for coming, and I want to thank everybody. Is there any of the ladies who would like to make a comment on this? Because we're due for a break in about 5 or 6 minutes. You want to come on up? Thank you again, Sherman.
Thank you for inviting us here.
I'm pretty loud. I'll just stand back here.
Okay. All right.
I'm very loud and I want to be heard.
It doesn't always help their
recording, though, Marcina, for staff have to record it?
Get you on the...
I'll sit in back there. My name is Marcita Eagleberry. I'm from Rosebud. I'm a director for the Tribal Treatment Program. And I work with both adults and adolescents. So for many years, I worked with the federal system. They'd refer. The state, however, is a different story. And we're sitting here talking about working together, and I think that's really important. You know, we're having to process some treatment plans or services plans for these kids when they get into trouble. And it's been working out fairly well with the federal and the tribal, but when it comes to the state, they don't recognize and honor tribal assessments. They don't recognize our program. Some of them don't. Just the other day, a mother called me and she said, you know, Marcita, my son went to the court in, I can't remember if she said White River or Winter. And she said he was supposed to get his assessment before this hearing. And she said, we went to your program and got his assessment done, and we did everything we're supposed to do, and we took it back, and the judge threw it out. The judge says that Rosebud is not accredited program, and he's not going to honor the assessment. So, but I'll have you know that my staff is state certified. We have credentialed employees as counselors, and we are not an accredited program, and we chose not to be. We are a tribal 638 program. We have a right to remain that way if we choose to. You know, I happen to think we have an awesome program in Rosebud. And I invite all of you to walk through my program anytime you're there. Stopping at my program. We just recently opened up a meth inpatient treatment there. So I wanted to mention that. That, you know, when you're talking about collaboration, you know, we have to really collaborate, not just talk about it. So, you know, it's about understanding and respecting each other's place. So I wanted to mention that. And I think about a year ago, your committee went to Rosebud. And I talked a little bit about another instance that was just similar to the one I'm sharing with you today. I wanted to stop. I'm tired of that. I'm just tired of the state not meeting us halfway. And so I just want to thank you. I'm sitting back there just ready to burst, but this is all I'm going to say for now, so thank you.
That's all right. I along that line...
I wanted to bring up something.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm with Assistant Wapton Oyate Tribe. I've worked... I work in the program with the youth as a CD counselor. I was listening to your stuff on communication with the judges. Okay, which is good to see where they're at, where they're going. But the question comes down to who does this? Who does the communication? Who has the time because of the excess load? Does it go back to probation officers? Then again, this is what we're about. We don't have probation officers. We don't have money for probation officers. You brought up family. The parenting programs. Oh, you don't know how many years I try to push this. The parenting. Again, most of my families that I work with that come through the systems, they have CD issues themselves. We can't get them into the parenting program unless we can get a judge to court order them. Then again, we don't have a family counselor for our program because we don't have the funds. The ideals are good, but we don't have the funding. And that's, again, where we come back with. Sorry, that's it. I had to say something, too.
name.
Oh, sorry. I'm like that with my tribe, too. I'm Teresa White. Teresa White. I'm with, like that with my tribe in Roberts County. I try to make us all collaborate together. But thank you for listening.
It's kind of a two-sworded knife, too, in a way, because I distinctly heard you say you wanted to be separate. In the case of I know in the case of my son, who got picked up in Rapid City his first time for drinking, he had to go through a assessment program and all these prior things. Well, he went back down to Pine Ridge and got it through the tribe, took it right to Rapid City, and they accepted it and they followed it. Now, I know that it doesn't always work that way. I don't know, maybe. But I know each tribe is, as you said, an individual. They're a sovereign individual. They make their decisions. And then if one tribe is working one type of program, that doesn't mean that this tribe is working that same program. So sometimes it's real hard, and I understand. We, and when I say we, we're only legislators. We're not the actual administrators of what goes on. So all we do is try to come up with things to help facilitate working with inner. One of our committee members has to go to another
meeting. I apologize. I have to go to another meeting. The chairman of the other meeting is meaner than you are.
All right.
So I have to run across to another meeting. I apologize for the rest of the very interesting discussion. I'll get with you and you can give me all the details.
All right. This will be mine.
Good afternoon. I'm Bev Tuttle. I'm with the Oglala Sioux Tribe, soon to be a tribal council representative for Porcupine District. I will be inaugurated tomorrow. However, prior to my inauguration, I've always been interested in what happens with children. I was also working with the Oglala Lakota Tribal Court-Appointed Special Advocacy Program. And I've always been involved in Indian child welfare issues. And I've attended as many invites as I could, and I'm very pleased to be here today because I will definitely take this back to our new council and our executive board, our new president, Steele. I told him I was coming today, and I think this is so serious about, you know, when our children, back in 2007, four times higher at risk of being, juvenile delinquent in whatever label they are, or capacity they put them in. And I'm sure by the 8 to 9, just going to be even higher. So that really concerns me as a tribal representative to be. So I I'm also very much in recognition of our sovereignty, but also looking at also building bridges for us between the state and the tribe, because I also very much worked with the initiative that Governor Rounds put out with called the Collaborative Circle regarding the disproportionality too with the foster care system. Now we're looking at disproportionality all around us, and which brings me back to transiency, children going into the cities, as Senator Maurer said. But that doesn't cause them to be delinquent up there, whatever city they are. That it's just that a lot of these children, because of their transiency, are taken and put into schools that maybe too aren't really sensitized enough to address Native American social issues that we have. And I know that the state has been putting culturally relevant, appropriate, maybe as best as they can, but it could be improved. And I think MOUs, memorandums of understanding, begins here with our state legislators, with our tribes, to better this disproportionality with our juveniles. A lot of our juveniles are lost in the system, our Native American children, because as a CASA, we can only go so far with our program. We cannot address juvenile delinquent issues. It's just for abuse and neglect issues. So when we look at look at back at our tribe, you know, I'm hearing the lack of some things we need. And that's a real issue. You know, we get programs, but they're not sustainable. We need to look for some type of sustainability. And maybe that sustainability is to leverage that with the MOU and looking at what the state can offer us and how we can collaborate. Because it's not about me. It's not about you. It's about the children. And that's where I really stand for. I speak here today looking behind me. I don't see the adults behind. I see these little children's faces because I've worked so hard for children for 12 years of my entire working life. Beyond that, it's 12 times 12 now. You know, I've been working over almost 30 years with children, and I also sat on the school board and for 14 years. So I do see the ramifications of what our children are in the decision-making that doesn't actually represent them. And there's this famous saying I want to end with. It's nothing about me without me. I think I saw in here that there was the juveniles were to be a part of whatever decision making, I understand, in here. Has that really happened, you know? Otherwise, you know, we could kind of see a curve of if they had a part in what was best for them. I think that's a big piece. So with that, I would like to just address that because I will be back and involved because I do truly care. And so I want to say Wopilan. Thank you.
Thank you, Bev. And I really want to congratulate you on being a new tribal member. After tomorrow, you will be making major decisions.
Yes.
And it's I know what a tough job that is to really. But I want to give you some good news. And you, as far as the state, I met with the Lieutenant Governor Matt Michaels this morning, and the news he gave me was that he and the governor plan to attend one tribal council meeting on every reservation themselves personally. I think this is an outstanding thing, I just think that I think this is really great. I think it's a good start towards some good relationships, because what to me is really bad is I honestly feel our people who are in Rapid City and Sioux Falls and probably in Pierre are our forgotten Indian people. Really and truly, the tribe is so overwhelmed by those of us that live on the reservation that sometimes we don't reach out to them. And I know from our own family experiences that sometimes we're crying out and nobody's there. And then the people that are handling it don't understand. So what happens is we end up in a bad situation. And like you, I've been working with children since I was 20 years old. I started out in Little Britches rodeos and school systems, and that's been my life. And these kids are, they're our future. That's it. So, but anyway, I want to congratulate you, and I know you will do a good job.
Thank you.
With that, we're due for a little break if you guys want to. And at this time, I'd like to introduce Luann Wardell, our director of the Office of Indian Education. At this time, Luann, we'll let you take over.
Got the red light. Can you guys hear me? Well, thank you for inviting me here. What I have with me today is just a real quick snapshot of what's been going on in the Office of Indian Education. And I also brought a handout for everybody that I thought everybody would find helpful. It was prepared from the National Caucus of Native American State Legislators, so everybody hopefully will have one of these. I would really ask the senators and the representatives if in the future they could take the time to read this, because what it does is gives a really, really good background information on the challenges and the day-to-day struggles that our children face in Indian country. So there's a lot of information there, but I think you'll find it very helpful. First of all, I think this is the second time I've been invited here. Again, I thank you for that. I see there's some people here that I haven't seen before, so I'd like to take a little bit of time to introduce myself. As Senator Bradford said, my name is Lou Ann Wardell. I'm an enrolled tribal member of the Sisseton Wahpeton Sioux Tribe. Grew up in North Dakota and then went to college down at a small school in Nebraska called Chadron State College and graduated from there. And then I spent a lot of time on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation as a counselor, a teacher, a principal for almost 20 years. And then went off to a graduate school in Oklahoma and got my master's in educational administration down there. And came back and started working at the Pine Ridge High School for about 5 years as the freshman director of a freshman academy. And that's kind of how I got involved in education, when I really started seeing the challenges and the day-to-day struggles that Indian children in South Dakota have to go through on a daily basis. So I'm very familiar with that, because I used to have lots of children from the seven districts, or the different districts in Pine Ridge, and have lots of friends that are teachers and administrators across the state and different reservations. So that's just a little bit of background about myself. As Senator Bradford said, my office is the Office of Indian Education. I'm the program manager. Budget is kind of small for the Office of Indian Education. We have about a $1.9 million budget, but the majority of that budget is from federal funds that we get through grant programs, such as Gear Up and College Access. Actual general funds is about $358,000. The Office of Indian Education was formally established by state statute in 2007, even though it had been functioning prior to that. And my office is charged with supporting initiatives in order that South Dakota students and public school instructional staff become aware of and gain an appreciation of South Dakota's unique American Indian culture. Therefore, my office works closely with an Indian Education Advisory Council, which consists of a representative from all 9 tribes, along with American Indian educators from all parts of the state. And talking about the Indian Advisory Council, just this year we have reorganized that entire structure. We have invited a representative from each tribe across the state, so we have new tribal members on the council. We also have superintendents and principals from the 5 largest public school districts on the council, such as Sioux Falls and Aberdeen and Pierre and Chamberlain and Rapid City, along with a BIE representative, tribal representative, tribal college representative, board of regent representative. And the purpose of that was to make sure that we had everybody's participation on this Indian Education Advisory Council, because I want to work very closely with this council in helping me determine policy and advice and just helping me with a lot of the challenges that I face on a day-to-day basis. So I'm very happy to say that most of those positions have been filled, except for 2. And we're going to be meeting during LNI out in Rapid City on December 15th. And looking forward to that meeting and also giving them an update on the Indian Education Office. Some more of my duties. I act as a liaison between the Department of Education and tribal education officials, the Bureau of Indian Education line officers and regional offices. I also work with K-12 educators across South Dakota, and recently returned back from D.C. and working very closely with the U.S. Department of Education's office. And when I say work closely, I have some grants that are funded from the Office of Indian Education, and that is some discretionary grants such as Wakongli and Wunshpe Tioshpe, different discretionary grants that we work with different schools across the state. So I visit with those people in D.C. probably about once every 3 months. Some of the, I guess, the most significant achievement of this office that occurred under my predecessor, Mr. Keith Moore, was the passage of the Indian Education Act in 2007. In addition to formally establishing the Office of Indian Education within the Department of Education, the Act mandated that any teacher new to the profession from out of state or certified after 1993 must complete a course in South Dakota Indian Studies. It also directed the department and the Indian Education Advisory Council to develop content in South Dakota American Indian history and culture to be used statewide. And I'd really like to focus on that for just a second. When I first came to Pierre on February 1st, I wasn't quite sure, to tell you the truth, what my job was, you know, as the director of Indian education. And as I've learned a lot in the last 10 months, and one of the initiatives that we have recently got really going, I'm very excited about, is those essential understandings that are eventually going to be creating the state standards for American Indian history and culture. And when you look at the job description, I think it's very important to remember that that's basically what my office is charged with. It's supporting initiatives in order that South Dakota students and public school instructional staff become aware of and gain an appreciation of South Dakota's unique American Indian culture. And before, I felt that I was getting pulled in different directions. How do I fix the achievement gap? How do I get more money in the budget? How do I do this and how do I do that? And I think I was visiting with Representative Junke earlier, I need to focus on the things that I have control over. So I'm more excited, and I'm focusing my strategic plan along those lines. And just wanted to throw that in there for you, because I didn't realize that that was the true scope of that South Dakota codified law. Also, this office is currently administering the South Dakota College Access Challenge Program. That's very exciting. The governor again awarded the Office of Indian Education the College Access Grant, which is $1.5 million a year for the next 6 years. That's very exciting, because the last 2 years it was only for $330,000 a year, so it's been increased substantially. And a lot of the questions is, what is the Office of Indian Education doing with this new grant? Well, I can share that with you, that we're working with over 30 high schools across the state, combination of public high schools, BIE schools, and private schools, with the purpose of transitioning those high school students on to post-secondary education. So we do a lot of different things. We have people out in the field that work with schools such as Timberlake, Mobridge, Winner, Pierre. And what they do is they'll go actually into the schools and work with the guidance counselors, ACT prep, financial aid training, all those things that sometimes become a barrier for Indian youth, trying to work one-on-one, a lot of one-on-one counseling. Because unfortunately, a lot of our people, the parents, don't have that necessary background in how to fill out paperwork, college applications, financial aid papers. It gets to be quite confusing. So I'm very excited about this, that we actually have people out in the field doing these things for a lot of the kids and families. And there's also a very strong parent connection there. We have to host family nights. We have to make sure that we meet with parents on a one-on-one basis on how to fill out all the paperwork, how to best educate your child in this whole post-secondary process. We're working on that very closely also. That's just one small piece of the college access. We're also sent out RFPs to the 6 Board of Regent colleges. They each got $40,000 to increase retention activities at their own institution. They have to create a climate of change that will be inviting and helpful to the Indian students that are coming to their schools and the ones that are presently in their schools. Because unfortunately, we only have about 2% of our high school graduates, Indian graduates in the state, that go on to post-secondary education in our Board of Regents schools. So that's a very important piece right there that we're excited about. Another piece that we have is working directly with the South Dakota Department of Ed. Are you all familiar with Mr. Mark Wilson, the director of the Office of Career and Technical Education? He also has a small piece of the College Access where he's creating dual credit classes with the technical institutes along with our partner high schools. So that's also very exciting. So that's a little bit about College Access. Our office currently administers the Gear Up South Dakota. I think a lot of people are familiar with Gear Up. Unfortunately, we're in the last year of a 6-year cycle. So we'll be looking to rewrite that grant sometime in January, February. And as you all know, in these fiscally challenged times, we're hoping that that we're successful in rewriting that grant and that we can get that refunded. The last one I'd really like to talk to you about is we're currently overseeing the work of the Essential Understandings Planning Group, which whole purpose is to define those core concepts essential to understanding and teaching the history and culture of all of South Dakota's American Indians through creating standalone social studies standards. That is a first. It's never been done before, having standalone standards. We're talking about social studies. That's very exciting. I've been learning a lot through this process. And how we came about this was that we invited different tribal representatives across the state to become part of this work group. And then after they had defined those essential understandings, it's now been pared down to about five experts. And I'd like to share those names with you. Stephanie Charging Eagle, Dorothy LeBeau, Lydia Whirlwind Soldier, and then Dan Snyder from here in Pierre. And I have a person, an Earl Bullhead from Lower Brule. So we have five curriculum experts, experts in their field that have been teachers and curriculum experts in Lakota, Dakota, Nakota curriculum. And once we get this group together, and they've been working about once a month, coming up with those essential understandings, they're now creating those standalone standards. And I thought in my excitement that this was going to be done overnight. But I've been working very closely with the curriculum department up at the Department of Ed and found out that this doesn't happen overnight. But what we do, what I can tell you is that the timelines are we'll have the standards finished by July of 2011. And then we take those standards to the State Board of Education, and they'll look at them and hopefully adopt them. And then we have to start working on how to integrate them into the rest of the core, Common Core standards that the Board of Ed recently voted on. And I have been told that it's about a two-year process that we'll actually have the curriculum in all of the public schools in South Dakota. But again, I'm very excited about this because we actually have the work group creating the standards right now, and we have a timeline of finishing them by July. Now, just if we have time, I'd like to read those essential understandings that the work group has come up with. There's seven essential understandings, and they modeled it after Montana's work group. There is diversity among the Lakota, Dakota, Nakota in their land base, languages, cultures, histories, and governments. The tribes have a distinct and unique cultural heritage that contributes to South Dakota culture. That's essential understanding number one, and then we'll create the standards from that essential understanding. Essential understanding two. There is a variety among individual tribal people as identity is developed, defined, and redefined by entities, organization, and people. A continuum of tribal identity unique to each individual ranges from assimilated to traditional lifestyle. There is no generic American Indian. Essential understanding number three. The thought and philosophy of the Lakota, Dakota, Nakota continues in the contemporary lifestyles of tribal members. Tribal cultures, traditions, and languages are incorporated into how tribes govern and manage their affairs and are observed by many tribal members both on and off the reservations. Essential understanding number four. Dakota Territory was under the stewardship and communal ownership of the Lakota, Dakota, Nakota tribes prior to immigrant settlement. There are many complex factors that contributed to the loss of land through treaties and legislative action, which have resulted in development of reservations. Essential understanding number five. Federal policies put into place throughout American history have affected the Lakota, Dakota, Nakota people adversely. Much of their history can be related to many major federal policy periods. Essential understanding number six. History told from the Lakota, Dakota, Nakota perspective through oral tradition and written accounts frequently conflicts with stories mainstream historians tell and becomes subjective information. Currently, historical perspective is being revisited to be more inclusive. Basically, that one is we want to include a lot of our history and culture into the textbooks in South Dakota. Essential understanding number seven. The treaties between the federal government and the Lakota, Dakota, Nakota recognize these tribes as sovereign nations. These nations have authority to enter into government-to-government relationships. Currently, the relationships with the state are not the same for each tribe. As I said before, the timelines in place are to be able to present the standards to the State Board of Education by July of 2007. So that was just a real quick, informal synopsis of the essential understandings. It will eventually be evolved into the standards, standalone standards. There's also some upcoming initiatives that my office is currently working on. I'll be writing a grant to increase more Indian teachers in the state. I was in D.C. a couple weeks ago, and I met with the Office of Indian Education and visited with them and asked to see some of the models of professional development that other states have had in increasing their Indian teachers. They shared three very successful grants with me that I can model. So I'm going to be working closely with Black Hills State College and Ogallala Lakota College, and we're going to submit this in February of 2011. Hopefully we can fund about 10 new teachers a year through this new grant that I'm going to write. We're also going to be writing a grant to develop the curriculum needed for those essential understandings that I mentioned prior to this. We also need money to create the curriculum, buy the curriculum, and train it and make it available to public teachers in South Dakota. Some of the challenges, you know, the state of education in our state's K through 12 schools for our Native American students is very distressing. I just attended the suicide summit last Thursday in Rapid City. It was very sad and depressing. You know, our children are killing themselves across all of our reservations and across South Dakota. So along with that, all the social ills, you know, we have the achievement gap that everybody's talking about all the time. You know, our Native students perform two to three grade levels below their white peers in reading and mathematics. Closing the achievement gap should be of key importance to state legislators because almost 70% of the Native American students in South Dakota attend public schools. And, you know, the state legislatures are ultimately are responsible for appropriations and policy that govern a state's public schools. So I think it's of the utmost importance that we know this data that affects the children on a daily basis. I do have some ideas on how to close that achievement gap that I'd like to share with you, just to use in future conversations and dialogue with interested people. I think our families need help in understanding the importance of education. Again, we're talking about some of our people that continue a cycle of not graduating from school. So I think we need to direct resources to help families understand the importance of education and what it can do for them. I think we need to make a concerted effort that drugs and alcohol addictions must be eradicated, and we need to direct resources towards that goal. Schools must be places of refuge where students, if they cannot feel secure at home, can come and be comforted, fed, clothed, and even housed if need be. There must no longer be a disconnect from home, school, and community. Schools in their new roles must become community education centers, similar to what tribal colleges have become. It really does take a village to raise a child. Schools need to take the lead in healthy lifestyles, offer healthy food, fruits, and vegetables, and require PE every day for everyone, students, staff, support staff, everyone in the school needs to be a priority. I believe tribal governments and tribal higher education departments must make education the number one priority in their agendas and make a commitment to education. Indian educators across the state must make learning fun and exciting for their students. I think the state needs to set bold goals that state public schools increase the graduation completion rate of Native American students to a minimum of 85%. Investing additional targeted funding in schools that have a four-year high school completion rate of less than 70%. I think we need to create a legislative task force to research and explore options to use distance learning as a tool for instructions for students who are at risk and for students in rural communities with hard-to-fill instructional areas and creating those alternative learning environments. My daughter graduated from the South Dakota Virtual High School in Shannon County. It was a wonderful opportunity for her. She went to a public school, K through 8, and then we started homeschooling her, and then she graduated from the South Dakota Virtual High School. It's a wonderful program in Shannon County. I believe that tribal nations with surplus financial resources must commit to helping the resource-challenged tribes. I think we need to have dialogues with the private sector foundations and corporations, and they must increase their financial support for Indian education and collectively give up to $1 billion annually to Indian education. I believe that the BIE Education Office and the Department of Education Office, I'm talking about nationally, of Indian Education must consolidate and become a national center for the promotion of excellence in Indian education. And I have many, many more ideas, but I know that you've had a long afternoon, and I know I need to close. But if you'd like to visit more about this, please contact me. I'm truly, truly passionate about Indian education and helping kids. And I guess the one thing I'd like to leave you with is that I think our schools, again, need to become support centers, caring, a whole circle of caring, whether it's emotional needs, financial, academic, all those areas that can help a child be successful. We can spend as much money as possible on building new schools and hiring teachers, but if we don't take care of some of the social ills that our people face on a daily basis, we're not going to be successful when it comes to educating our children. I would like to invite the Tribal Relations Committee to work closely with my Indian Education Advisory Council to discuss the preliminary research and to help develop policy recommendations aimed at closing the achievement gap among Native American students. Once again, thank you for listening to me, and I'm here to answer any questions that you may have or offer any insight that I think I may have. But it's been enjoyable visiting with you. Thank you.
Does any of the committee have questions? I'd like to thank you for coming, Luann, and you know, we have to get back to schools being the center of a community. We deviate away from that because of somewhat, I've seen it since I've gotten the legislature, of small towns. We're trying to consolidate schools and on a financial basis, of course, and sometimes that's not the thing to do, because a school is a community, and mm-hmm. it takes a community to raise a child, and it takes a community, and it takes a school to keep a community. You just don't, so many times if a school disappears, a community disappears, and it's just we get lost in this big thing of going where we think everything is. And I'm talking about towns that have, you know, the things to do for our younger people, and so in turn they take that child there, and he often gets very lost in this educational process. And we all know in this day and age how tough it is to make a living. So I know in the case of my daughter, she's got a little one in Head Start, and both her and her husband are working. Now, you know, it's really hard to come home at night and work all day and come home at night and say, what'd you do today in school? Mm-hmm. You sit down and we'll talk about it. It's let alone those children who are like my grandson. Grandpa's the guy that he comes home to and to sit down and say, boy, you're doing great, and what can I do? What can I do? How can I be involved? And so I think of the things you spoke about, and I see a lot of passion in you, Luann, and I think the office is only as good as the people who run it. And so I look for some good things from you, and I hope that comes about, because you're going to have a big effect on those children, especially those children, as you say, who are out in public education. Mm-hmm. That's where we can do something.
Sure.
And you can. So mm-hmm. I know that I've been into education for eternity, and I know how that
is, because in the case of my wife, Shirley, out of 11 children, she's the only one to graduate from high school. And in my family, out of 6 children, I'm the only one that ever got to college. So, and it took me till I was almost 45 years old before I got it done, but I did get it done. And this is what, it, you know, it's a proven fact that if mom and dad graduate high school, the chances of the child graduating high school just go up extremely, in the same way on to higher education.
Exactly. So, the importance of role models is so important.
And it's so important for us to get the importance of education to that parent. Mm-hmm. That parent has to realize how important. Anyway, Luann, if there's any not any more questions, Representative Pitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I remember when, I believe it was last year or the summer before, Stuart Zephyr was in front of us and presented that time and mentioned something about testing, the difference between Native American students in schools and other schools in the state as far as the standardized test that
the Dakota STEP.
Okay.
Yeah, in reading and math.
And I apologize for being late. Is there any updates on that or any changes that have happened over the last year or two?
Other than the scores, I can share with you is that they're very distressing. Like I said in my report, that we the Native students are behind 2 to 3 grade levels across the board. But there's a lot of factors that play into the Dakota STEP scores. I believe some of the testimony that you heard prior to me with the tribal juvenile justice and then some of the things that I talked about that affect our children on a daily basis. To tell you the truth, I think the Dakota STEP scores are the least of our worries right now. We need to find ways to help our kids come to school and be successful. I mean, there's so many challenges that they face on a daily basis that when they come to school and take a test, it's probably not the most important thing on their agenda that day. That's, you know, our Dakota STEP scores are definitely very disproportionate in the state.
Just a quick follow-up. Is that true whether it's a public school or
there's a gap in the the gap that we talk about is basically the public schools. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. Luann, you said, and I'm sure that's evolving, you're prioritizing where you can make a difference. I mean, and you didn't put them 1, 2, 3, or you probably didn't put them in a priority list for your priorities. Or did you, and I just didn't pick up on them?
No, there was no order of priorities. You know, one of the things that we were sharing with at our Indian Ed Summit back in Chamberlain in September was that Secretary Oster and Melody and myself were going to work very closely with the Indian Education Advisory Council in creating some type of strategic plan with the Indian Education Advisory Council to address that achievement gap. I'll be meeting with them next week. I have put together very detailed data, such as the Dakota STEP scores, NAEP data for the last 5 years, trends. Basically, we're going to share all that data with the Indian Education Advisory Council next week, and then we're going to basically ask them their input. Again, I think Secretary Oster was very committed to the fact that he wants answers to come from Indian country. He didn't want any more answers or programs coming from the state. So, no, that's a huge priority, the achievement gap and all that. But we're going to present it to the Indian Advisory Council members and then see if we can come up with a plan in that group and then present it back to, probably come back to your group and also to the management team up at the state of South Dakota.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to be rhetoric, but somehow I feel that we have to look at the, everybody hates it when I say we, but we have to look at what the parochial system does. Because in Pine Ridge, the highest achieving children are going to Red Cloud.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I told Keith Moore this, and I'll tell you this. What are they doing? Because let me tell you, they're educating kids who are out of families, and some of that family's going to a public school, some of it's going to a BIE school, and some's going to a tribal school. Well, when they go to Red Cloud, they have to not only pay for their child to go there, they have to sometimes, as I did for my grandson, stand in line.
Mm-hmm.
And for my own son, I stood in line down at Red Cloud. But don't knock the fact that they still produce high achievers. I mean high achievers. And it's we just have to at least look at what they're doing. And I know that in the public school system, we are very much don't like to look at other types of systems, you know.
Sure. So. Well, you know, Red Cloud does a wonderful job. You know, I'm very familiar with their administrators, their students, their families, and you know, again, they're a private school though, and you can't really compare a private school to public, because a private school doesn't have to accept special education children. They can have entrance tests that not all the students can pass. They can kick kids out that don't come to school after 10 days. The public schools, you know, they have to work with all students. Don't get me wrong. I know all about Red Cloud, and they do a great job. But they'll start the year out with, you know, they'll start a freshman cohort of class of 70 students, and they'll graduate 40. So, you know, they lose students also. In our public schools, you know, they have to work with all the kids on our IEPs. They have to work with all the students that they possibly can and do the best job that they can. So, yes, I totally agree with you that Red Cloud's a wonderful school, but it's kind of an unfair comparison when you talk about public schools, because public schools cannot turn students away. I guess that's the bottom line.
Well, I don't disagree with you that they are. But you can take, why is it that you can take a child and he can go from our school into that school and become a good achiever when he's come out not being a good achiever?
Sure.
So, I mean...
No, they do many things well.
I'm just saying, we got to look at the good.
Mm-hmm.
And if it is, we got to be realistic.
Sure.
If it's a fact that they can discipline children, that's just what you said, then the public education better look at that avenue themselves.
I agree.
So,
yes.
Let's not be scared to take the good and say, okay, this needs to go in too. And if it's a commitment of the parent, they've got a commitment of that parent. Then we need to get a commitment of the parents, because we're letting that child down by not doing it. That's what we're doing. We're not hurting anybody but the child.
No, I totally agree with you, Senator Bradford. That was one of my very first things, that we have to help families learn or show them how important education is, you know, and be an advocate for the families. You hit it right on the, you hit the nail right on the head. You know, I agree.
Anyway, I thank you a lot.
Sure. Thank you. All right.
We're down to public testimony. Be sure you've signed our thing or signed in or something if you want to testify.
Thank you. address Luann's report, yes, and your concern, Senator Bradford, you know, why does the parochial school put out better achievement and successes with their children? Well, I agree with Luann that, you know, they don't, they have, they don't have to take just any child. And yes, special education is something they don't do. But I think with along those lines, we're looking at a big piece here is parental involvement. And from the school I'm from, Porcupine, we have a every month we have a night called I Care Night. And parental involvement is excellent, very excellent. But we also have the standards course, which I'm not a believer in as a school board member. I'm more interested in the child, yes, to read. They can learn to read. They can do math. You know, the basics of math. I learned that. I went to a parochial school all my life. I learned to read. I learned to do math. That was efficient, sufficient for me. I feel like I'm successful today. I think what's happening with a lot of our systems, other than the parochial schools, is we're given so many curriculum documents that we have to utilize, and I think that's where the falling down is, you know. And I as a tribal member working on the tribal education grad school, is that we need to get back to the basics, and the core of that is citizenship, and we can customize citizenship with our cultural practices, and that's something I'm really pushing at our school. Is yes, you need to be successful in this world, this mainstream America. Need to have values. Those are things that I think we really need to expound on. I'm not worried about the test scores because they don't tell me a darn thing. We could give them another test. They may be able to pass that test. I'm more interested if the child can read and write and be a good behavior with values that are taught. And so, me coming from the tribal perspective, I think we have a lot of children. We've got to deal with what we have right now. I would really like to see a residential treatment center, one residential treatment center that is tribally run, so that our children, we have so many children in residential treatment right now that are forgotten. And I think I've gone to visit some of these places. There's children sitting in there for over 2 years now. They shouldn't be sitting there. But because there's nowhere else for them to go, I'm thinking, you know, and then the parents are distanced from them. They never get visits because, again, having the resources, because most of the time these parents are the children that are in extreme poverty. If you say, you know, I don't like that word, because I believe I probably grew up in poverty myself, because I didn't have electricity, I didn't have running water. But however, I had some values in my life. And so I'm thinking, if we could teach those core things in our school system, you know, being valuable, we need to make them feel valuable in our schools. And that's across the whole state of South Dakota, whether you're tribal school, but I also want to see us really moving with the state recognizing us to get our own residential treatment placement. I think that would really be a starter for us, because we can gather all these children that need the specialized help, but they will have access to their families. Right now they don't. So I just wanted to plug that in. You may be coming forth with some type of a proposal, because I've been looking at this for years, and I started doing some research with the Navajo Nation, and they've come to our tribe and showed us how they got them going in their tribe. And I would really like to sensitize our non-tribal members here to really think about it. We could have one tribal residential treatment center, and we'll probably collaborate with all our sister tribes here and see how we could utilize that for our children.
Well, I, you know, nothing's new to me. I'll tell you right now, I didn't have any running water either. In fact, I worked with horses most of my life. But education, my mother, and I always think about The biggest example in is at home. I think about Grandma Rifle. Grandma Rifle spoke Lakota, no English, so she conversed with my father, who was non-Indian, and my mother was some. But he spoke Lakota to her, so. But her husband, John Rifle, was worked in the bureau and came out to Parmalee, Rosebud area, and married Grandma Rifle. She was a burning breast. But she insisted. She's the one who insisted her children get an education. You go to school every day and you learn. You know, her children were, of course, we all know Ben Rifle, what he turned out to be, probably one of the greatest from our community. Right next to him was a brother who became a doctor, one of the most proficient doctors in the country. Another one that became well-educated and became into the Bureau. But it was that home incentive. It's right now at our house, just down the road, is my daughter. And she has three daughters. The oldest one's in first grade. If that girl stays with her mom, when the bus comes, she's never ready. So she calls me, and I go get her and take her to school. But if she comes to our house and grandma, she don't like to be called grandma, by the way, but if grandma's there, that child's up and ready, and that bus, that public school bus, comes right to our door. You know, the old saying goes, I walked I don't know how many miles to school. No, that's not true. But it is good that school bus comes right to our door, and it comes right to my daughter's door. But somehow she doesn't have that importance that little girl needs to be in school every day. And when she comes home, she needs to be talked to about what school means and what. And I'm telling you, somehow we have to get that to those young parents. And how you do it, Bev, and I admire you. We're all working towards the same goal. Because what we want is them to go out and have a good, successful life, not have the children end up over here in the penal system, which is the way, you know, it's more of a tendency. So I just hope that, and I don't think you ever will. You'll never give up, Bev. So you just hang in there. Once we get these ideas, because I see you as kind of a leader, a good leader, to bring these people into it. Instead of saying, no, you can't tell us anything we can do to better educate our Indian children. Instead of that, bring them in. And those who are successful, whatever they're doing, just like Beth said, they're trying some really good ideas down there at that school. And if they work, then we need to be jumping right on the bandwagon. And that's what I want to see. I guess I'm probably when you come again, the next tribal relations, I sure will probably not be chairman. I'll still be on the committee, but I'm sure I won't be chairman anymore. But I don't, I'm not ashamed of anything we've done. In my 2 years here, I feel like we've listened to the people and we're interested in making progress for better relations. That's what this committee is all about, is better relations between our tribes and the state. And that's what this is all about. We take both people's ideas and what's good for all of our people, you know. And so with that, I guess I would ask if there's any more testimony. If there's not, we'll go on to closing and okay.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you've done an excellent job over the last term. You have the issues. You ran a good meeting without input of the staff. You're always easy to get a hold of, and I think your heart's, you know, you wear it out there on your sleeve, and you're very forthcoming with it. And it's just unfortunate that you probably will not be chairman. I don't know if I'll be back on this one because of the change of my committees too. But you know, I've done two terms on this, and it's always an eye opener, and I enjoy it. And I was visiting with Teresa, you know, going to Sisseton was one of the highlights. I have to say, of this last term, is I thought we were treated very, very cordial up there. I was very impressed, and I hope you take that back. I mean, we relayed that when we were here. So I think you did an excellent job, and you've been a committee member, a very contributing member of the committee. So I want to thank you as a member for you being a chairman for the last term.
Mr. Chair, I would hate to let Representative Junkie be the only member of the House to say anything. I too have appreciated being on the committee, both with you and with our Vice Chair, Representative Junkie. Actually, I asked to be on the committee. I think it's been a great learning experience. I grew up in Flandreau, right in the middle of reservation land, basically, and have always been interested and tried to do whatever I could to work towards working together, I guess, in that sense. And so I hope, because I didn't run again, so I won't be back on the committee, but I hope that it will continue, and I hope that it starts to triage or triangulate with the Office of Indian Education, whatever the governor has as far as an office, the 100 years of reconciliation, that we really work hard at those things and that we're all talking to each other, because sometimes I feel too that maybe we haven't had as much communication between everyone, and I think that will take us where we want to go. And I think this is a very important committee, and I appreciate the number of meetings that we've had this year because of that, and I think, like Representative Junkie, we have learned a lot this year, and that helps to foster that communication as we move forward. So good luck. I hope you both will be back on the committee, because I think that history of what we've been doing is so important, and maybe Senator Maher will also be on it. So thank you.
Especially too, I want to really thank Tom. I want to tell you something. Without Tom, honestly, he did tremendous. He made all the contacts, got people organized, and I really, really, without him, it just wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't. And so I do want to make a special thank you, Tom, for everything you've done. And I seriously. I know probably Luann said he calls me pretty consistently until he found out where you were going to come. Anyway, and I really want to thank you people for coming. And Dev, especially you, I know you got a big day tomorrow. And for you to come up here, that's a special thing. I you don't know how much that means to me to have you, because sometimes I can't hardly get my whole committee, let alone. So thanks again. And you, Marianne, too. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, are we going to talk about proposed legislation at all? Or?
Yeah, we could. Legislation.
One of the ideas I had was going back to Sisseton with that individual up there. Who is there some way we could say that if you're a tribal member and you wanted to use your National Guard stipend to be used at a tribal school, is there any reason why we couldn't run something like that? If you're a tribal member, go ahead, Tom.
As I think about it, probably not. It would take a change in the statute, of course. The thing that's unusual about it is that the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs actually money comes from their budget to reimburse the school's expenses. So maybe that can put up the private.
Right.
Other guy got any place with it, but I you don't get any place if you don't introduce it. But I like that one.
Yeah. Another interesting thing about the program service command in the member of the South Guard and your resident of Minnesota across the border.
I would say if you're a tribal member and you want to go to a tribal school, you should be able to use those funds any way you wanted to.
Yeah.
Now, I don't agree with a white person probably going into a tribal school situation and doing that, because if we already heard that the tribal schools already lose money on white people.
Yeah.
Although they might
appreciate at least half the money.
For them, you know, they get nothing for them the way it is. Andy would be non-discriminatory. I can just say, why are you segregating out these? It wouldn't matter. I think if this guy's a guard guy, white, maybe he's married to a woman down or a woman. In fact, we got a guy out there by your head. She's off in the army over in Iraq.
Take care of me.
I do think that it'd be an easier bill to go through if it was not open. And I think those guys would be happy to get something out of it. But certainly educated guy. They'll take look at the other category.
Otherwise, you guys will just sit there and think, oh, yeah. Ah.
Okay.
Well, you can introduce him without a second. You don't have to have to be subjected to the vote losing your amendment.
But
he's on the internet, Mr. Chairman.
In the committee.
Yeah.
No, I'm on.
Yes.
We're not on.
Yeah, yeah, we are. We have an engineer.
You're on the internet. Besides that, it ain't.
I think it's recorded, it's just that one.
That's all.
So you might want to turn it off. You might hit another
Well, we like that.